We're up to the last phrase of the Mishnah. Even though a person should make his house open to everyone, and he should make poor people feel as if they are members of the household, with all the other explanations we gave on that in the past, still a person has to be careful. Altar besicha im ha'isha. Don't be overly verbose in speaking frivolous and meaningless talk, even with one's own wife, surely with other people's wives or other women. And the Mishnah ends that a person who doesn't listen to this is in the end going to cause himself evil and end up in Gehenna. Okay, last week we explained the reason why the Torah is so strict, and the rabbis even more so, with the separation of the genders. We said basically that from a purely practical standpoint, the attraction between men and women is a very, very strong attraction. Kadosh Baruch Hu made it like that in order that there should be a very strong physical bond between a husband and wife. And but that is where that attraction is supposed to be used in a positive way. But the same attraction can be used for the negative. Every drive, every thing that's in the world, zele umaze, is parv. You can use it for the good, you can use it for the bad, equally. So that attraction can lead to holiness, kedushin. Marriage is called kedushin. Or it can lead to the worst tumos, to the worst impurities and distortions and depravities. Secondly, we said that aside from that, that a person can never be assured that they are fully protected and on guard unless they make themselves on guard and very much make fences around themselves in these areas. Aside from that, even if nothing ever will come that is terrible sins, but just being not holy is something wrong with the Jewish people. That we are supposed to be a holy nation, and therefore even improper thoughts, improper speech is also prohibited. Not only actions that are serious actions, but even things that are very subtle are also prohibited, and therefore too much contact between the sexes is a breach of holiness. That's basically what we said. We got into a discussion last week about buses where women sit in the back and men sit in the front or whatever, and there was a lot of discussion about that. I want to make one comment concerning that and then go on to finish the Mishnah, unless there are any other points of discussion that people want to bring up. I'll tell you a story, and the moral of the story fits this idea, I think, very nicely. When I was a rabbi in Miami, so I had a, I think she was about a 16-year-old girl that was a balas tshuva. Her parents were influenced. In fact, I didn't even know who her father was or if she had a father, because she grew up and lived with her mother. She's an only child. She grew up with her mother. The mother knew nothing about Yiddishkeit. Zero. The girl joined a youth group, NCSY, and she became frum through that youth group in Miami. And the girl attended my shul. Now, the mother was a very, very good mother. And she didn't fight the girl about the fact that she wanted to be frum, as many parents do. Right? Many parents would rather their children be drug addicts than be frum. But this was a good mother. And she did not resist her daughters wanting to become religious, and she helped her as much as she could, but she didn't know too much, and she was bewildered among the things that the girl came home with, you know, as she found out more and more things about Yiddishkeit, or things that she thought were Yiddishkeit. And as is the custom of fresh Balei Tshuva, she was very much machmir, even on things that didn't exist. In Yiddishkeit, the things that she thought were supposed to be done or whatever. So the mother used to call me and ask me, is this really necessary? My daughter came home and said, you know, she has to have this, that, whatever. Is it really necessary? Is this really something that, you know, is she making a mistake or whatever? And one day the mother calls me and she says, Rabbi, I thought you were an Orthodox rabbi. I said, I am. She says, then why don't you eat kosher? I knew something was coming. I said, okay, let me hear what the... She said, my daughter came home, and she said, we can no longer buy meat in the butcher shop, that you are one of the people who give the hashgacha to that butcher shop. It was the Rabbinical Council of Miami, which I was a part of, gave the hashgacha to that butcher shop. It was basically the butcher shop of the community, a glatt kosher butcher shop. Because the meat there is not kosher, we have to get different meat. What was the background? There was one butcher shop in Miami, a glatt kosher butcher shop that serviced the entire community. The meat was shipped in from Denver. There was no local meat in Miami. There was no local shechita in Miami. There wasn't grazing land there. They didn't raise cattle for shechita, and everything had to be brought in from out of the state. And the meat was OU, glatt, and the only problem was that was the most advantageous place to bring the meat in from. It wasn't what they call chassidische shechita, meaning that it was kosher, 100%, it was glatt kosher. But the shochtim didn't meet the standards of what some chassidim hold is important. Example, by chassidische shechita, the shochtim have to have beards, right? They also have to have other qualifications too, but in addition to the other qualifications, they have to have beards. So
women now.
Right. There were some chassidim in the community that wanted to bring in meat that met these higher standards. It had nothing to do with kashrus, right? They had to do basically with hidurim. And one of these mahadram was kapedus that they had, which was fine. So they got together, a small group of people, and they brought in meat from a different source, privately. Because though it was such a small group of people, this meat could not be brought in for the general public. It just wasn't possible. But it could be brought in by private people. So they could only bring it in and butcher it, once or twice a year. So if you wanted to order, you had to order like a 4/4 of an animal. Right, so you had to get a special freezer just to hold that meat. Nobody had room in the regular freezer for a whole half an animal. And the meat cost about double or triple what the regular meat cost. And you had to travel to a central pickup place, which was 25, 30 miles outside of Miami. Round trip about 50, 60 miles. So That was the situation in Miami at the time. So this girl came home. She found out about this chassidische shechita, and she understood that the meat that she was using up until now, which came from the glatt kosher butcher shop that all the rabbis gave their hashgacha to and bought from, was not kosher. And the only kosher meat was this meat that was brought in for chassidische shechita. And therefore, she told her mother, you're going to have to buy a freezer. You're going to have to travel 60 miles to pick up this meat, and the meat cost three times as much as the normal meat cost, which itself cost about twice as much as a normal meat cost. So we're talking about astronomical figures. So the mother says, I don't understand, Rabbi. You're supposed to be an Orthodox rabbi, and you eat from that non-kosher butcher shop, and my daughter has to buy only kosher meat from... So I said, let me take care of this. So I called the girl in, and I told her the following. It says that the Aron was covered with gold on the outside and covered with gold on the inside, and the Aron itself is made of wood. It was a wooden box, but it was covered with gold on the outside and gold on the inside. And the Chachamim say that the symbolism of the Aron being covered with gold on the inside and the outside is that a Talmud Chacham should be tocho kebaro. He should be through and through gold on the inside, gold on the outside. Same way he is on the outside, he should be on the inside, and vice versa. The Daz Akenemi Balei HaTosfos asks on that, and he says, if that's the symbolism of the Aron, wouldn't it be better if the Aron were made of solid gold? That would be much more symbolically positive symbolism. Solid gold. Why just gold on the outside and gold on the inside? Gold through and through. He says, true. Symbolically, it would have been much better if the Aron was solid gold, but it would have been too heavy to carry. A box of those dimensions made of solid gold would have been much too heavy to carry. He said, even though a miracle happened, and the Aron carried the people who carried it, but ain't somchem al hanes, we don't rely on miracles. You had to be able to be carried naturally, without miracles. What I learned from that, I told this girl, is the following. Sometimes you could want to be solid gold, but if you're not the one carrying yourself, somebody else has to carry you, then it's better to be wood on the middle and just gold on the inside and gold on the outside. I said, you know, someday in Mirsa Hashem you'll get married and you'll want to make the standards of your home solid gold. That's very good. When you have to pay the money and you have to buy the freezer and you have to make the 60 mile round trip. But if your mother is carrying you, so if it's Shabbos, Kashrus, then there's no place to compromise. But you want to be solid gold and use meat that's extra special, that's very, very nice, but not at somebody else's expense, at your expense. When you'll be able to have the expense, then you'll do it. When it'll be, when it's your mother's expense, that's a different story. You can't be mahadir on somebody else's cheshbon. And she accepted that, and that was that for the time. Same thing over here. It's clear that halachically, it's okay to get on a bus, even if the bus looks like the subway in New York during rush hour, which means that people are packed in like sardines, men, women, and varied other, in the New York, sundry people. Okay. Right, and whatever. If you're ever in the subway in New York, you know what I'm talking about. In any case, there is no halachic problem with it. Being sandwiched in like that is not endearing physical contact. If anything, it is the opposite. Okay. And therefore, halachically, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about it. There is absolutely nothing wrong halachically with being on a bus where people are packed together. On the other hand, definitely it's a hither if men and women could be separated on a bus, and especially if the women want that and the men want it. Everybody's happy with it. But if
it often happens on those crowded subways that a not beseder person takes it.
Okay, so not beseder people are not beseder. That doesn't mean that nobody can go on the subway. Okay, it means stay away from not beseder people or call the police. But because there are crazy people in the world, and if you're a crazy person like that, you shouldn't go on the subway. If that's what you're going on the subway for. But normal people, right, who go on the subway are not going there to be able to squeeze against people of the other gender. Right? That's not the case. Okay? If it is the case, then those people shouldn't use the subway, and you shouldn't be near those people who are on the subway. Okay. But 99% of the time, that's not the case. So halachically, it's 100% mutter. The only thing is that for sure there's a hither if you can arranged that it should be separate, that you shouldn't have to come onto that. Okay, that's a hider. That's not halacha. Because it's a hider, like I said, if it doesn't affect anybody else, not anybody else's cheshbon, then it's very nice to be mahadar. But if you're mahadar on the expense of somebody who gets on the bus, who has 3-4 little children, can't get into the back, can't make it to the back because they can't walk that far, or a million other reasons, then you have to be mavater on your hither for somebody else's basic needs. And people, most people understand that too. And I would say, look, I don't travel on buses, right? I don't even know how much a bus costs. And twice a year, I go on a bus because I go to the coastal and it's very difficult to park there. So I park my car in Geula and take a bus to the coastal and back. And that is it. So I can't talk about buses. Not separate ones, not mixed ones, or whatever. Okay. People tell me that for the most part, people are menschlich. And if there's a reason why a woman has to sit in the front of the bus, they don't make a big deal about it. There are people, though, who, there's no other word for it, are crazy. Crazy meaning that they don't know how to balance things properly. And they don't know what takes precedence over what. And in the quest of their hidurim and chumras, right, they are willing to be over other isurim that are much more serious. Right? Rachman son, an almona gets on the bus and she can't make it to the back. Right? So there's an isur d'oraisa of being ma'ana and almona. That's an isur d'oraisa. It's not a hider, it's not a chumra. So to make this woman feel terrible is okay, because if you're hider that you don't want to sit near some old almona on the bus, that's absurd. But some people don't have the seichel to know how to balance things out properly. I remember Shlomo Zalman Orbach, that he was on a bus, and then in those days they didn't have separate buses, seating. And he was sitting towards the front of the bus, and a woman got on who was not dressed necessarily very tzanua, and she sat right next to him. Now, you would think that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach should have gotten up immediately, right, like he was bitten by a snake, and jumped out of the seat and whatever. Or at least take out a spear and spear the woman through. But one of the two things, l'chara, would make sense, right, according to most people. He sat there, didn't react, sat. The next stop was not his stop. He got up nicely and left the bus and took the next bus. He didn't want to embarrass this woman by jumping up, right? And he felt that halachically there's nothing wrong with sitting where he was. And the nice way to do it is, without embarrassing anybody, I don't have to stay in this situation unnecessarily, so I'll take the next bus. So he got out. He didn't spit at the woman, yell at her, right, get somebody to spear her through, or jump up and insult her. But he understood that if you balance everything out, the least of all the evils is to stay in the seat till the next thing and be a chacham and leave the bus. That was all. That's a chacham. But unfortunately, a lot of people in this world are not chachamim, or to say the least. And therefore, this whole hullabaloo of the separate buses came up. It has nothing to do, again, in neighborhoods where people want that, it's a nice hither, as long as they understand that it can't be on somebody else's cheshbon. That's all. It's a hither, and a hither, it's not, Rav Eliyashiv said that it's a nice thing to do. You can't force the public to have buses like that. It's not something that a person, that's Rav Eliyashiv said. Right? If it would be a halacha, then you can force the public not to ride buses on Shabbos. Yeah, that's something that you're mechuyev to do. But it's a hider, it's a very nice hider, but it's not something you can force people to do. Okay, I think that is enough said about the topic. Yes?
What about shekels?
Shekels on buses? Shekels on... What is the... My Rosh Yeshiva told me that anything that somebody is not courageous enough to sign, ignore it. Because anonymous posters, even if they tell you to keep the Aseres HaDibros, right, ignore it. Keep the Aseres HaDibros because you have to, not because some poster said it on the wall. Even... Rav Yoshe never said such a thing.
No, the what about
the
okay. Everything else is fine.
I don't know how we got onto shekels, but okay. The okay, but the truth is, this is part of Pirkei Avos, since we're talking about Altar B'Sicha and Ma'isha. Okay, I'll answer it quickly, and then we'll go on.
What's the question?
The question is like this. There is a difference of opinion amongst poskim, like there's a million different things. It's not the first thing where there's an argument. Whether a woman, a married woman who has to cover her hair, covering it with something that looks like her hair, is that okay? There's even an opinion that says she can take her hair, cut it off, and make a shekel out of it, and put it back on, and it's okay. Okay, you can use your own hair for a shekel. Not just somebody else's human hair, your own hair. And the Mishnah Berurah seems to say that's okay. There is an opinion that says no. Anything that looks like human hair, right, is not allowed. The covering has to be a covering, not covering with something that appears to be hair. For the most part, Ashkenazi poskim, it's not across the board, but for the most part, the Ashkenazi poskim are matur wearing a shekel. Sfardi poskim, for the most part, were not matur wearing shekla. And therefore, Sfardim are, to the most part, wear coverings other than wigs, and Ashkenazim wear coverings that are that are even wigs. This is, Baruch Hashem, a fine generation, where the shaila is, what kind of covering? Two generations ago, the question was, should you cover your hair altogether? Mm-hmm. Most women, married women, didn't cover their hair. Even in Litta, it was a mitzvah that unfortunately was not kept. Doesn't mean it was okay, but it was not kept. Whatever reason. In different generations, there are different mitzvahs that aren't kept. In any case, but now, Baruch Hashem, most people from all different, kinds of Jews married women cover their hair. Now the only question is, how are you supposed to cover it? So again, there are poskim who definitely say that wigs are okay, and the poskim will say that they're not okay. If you follow a posik who says it's not okay, you shouldn't do it. And if you follow a posik who says it's okay, you can do it. And for people to say that people who do it following a posik are doing something wrong, they're wrong. Everybody has a right to follow their posik, especially when they're legitimate, very chashuv poskim who say both ways. Now, there's another problem. Wigs, just like clothing. Nobody holds that you can't wear clothing. Okay? But, once you're supposed to wear clothing, there's the type of clothing to wear. And clothing, even if it's sanua in so far that it covers your body, and this goes for men and for women, but more so even for women, it's not enough just to cover your body. But you have to cover your body in a way that is sanua, that's modest. Because you can cover every part of your body that has to be covered, but do it in a way that is provocative and attracting, not attractive, attracting, and extremely immodest. Okay? People can wear clothing that is tight, that is provocative, and it covers every part of the body. So just covering the body that has to be covered is not enough. It has to be done in a tasteful, modest way. Same thing goes with a wig. No different than anything else. Right? Wigs should be tasteful, not provocative, not attracting, and there's one other condition. A woman who's married, people should know she's a married woman. They shouldn't think she is a young girl who's unmarried. Because there are definitely dangers in married women walking around as if they're schoolgirls. It's not a healthy thing, not for the woman and not for other people, and it is definitely a safeguard for things that are not proper if everybody knows who's a married woman, who's not a married woman. Okay. Therefore, a shetel should be the kind of wig that fulfills those conditions. They're not provocative, they're not attracting, they are not and they look like a shetel. You know that this is not the woman's natural hair. Okay?
Well, the modern shetels look like hair.
No, they look like hair, but they don't. You can still tell that somebody's wearing a shetel. There are shetels that are different, that are made to look natural as if they have the scalp. That's not the run of the mill thing. Not the run of the mill. In any case, so therefore, the Rabbanim gave klolim of what kind of shetels normally are provocative, attracting and not attractive, and so on. However, there are exceptions. It really depends on a person's facial features, right? For some women, what looks good on them, not attracting, provocative, or whatever, is a longer shetel, because that's the way that their makeup is, their facial features are. So there are exceptions to the rule, and there are women that the shorter shetel looks provocative or whatever. So the general rules are what's been given out. That there can be exceptions to the rule, can be exceptions to the rule. But the general rules are to keep what I'm telling you. Yeah.
You can't force separate seating, as Robin said. And I believe, of course, it goes along with tzniut, as there are sections of our country that people are forcing tzniut even on children. But what is the rough stand on that? You can't force tzniut if you're part of a community that has all kinds of.
Yeah, again, you can't force your standards of hidurim on other people. But
child
the truth is
going to school.
Okay, that's an aberration. That is not that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about tznius. We're not talking about something that's chukos hagoyim because it's copying the Arabs. I don't even want to get into that because it's not. It's an aberration. What can you do? It's not. Nobody holds it. That's okay. Yeah.
When I was working as a counselor, I met with counselors, religious women who were counselors in other places, and they always wanted to talk to me. One young woman explained to me she was divorced. And her friends were divorced. And she went to the rabbi to explain. When they went out to a...
They didn't cover their hair.
Thing, everybody knew they had been married. And they wanted to go without the shaving. And I don't remember what happened.
Yeah, that, Ramosha Feinstein says that a woman who's divorced or widowed, even though preferably she should cover her hair, but if it will cause her a loss of a job or something like that, or her chances of remarrying will be diminished because she covers her hair, there's heterim not to cover her hair. Mm-hmm. So that's Ramosha Feinstein. Not everybody agrees with that. But there are heterim for women who are married or who were married but are no longer married now not to cover their hair. Okay. Let's go on. Okay. Adkan. Okay. Now, there's other explanations of what Altar B'Sichem Ha'isha is, and they may be more troubling to you, so we're going to have to spend time explaining them also. The...
Let's suppose something is not a hitter.
Okay, we finish that. That's
right.
When we get to another Mishnah that perhaps speaks about Gilei Arayos, we'll get to it again. Okay, next. Another thing that they say that you shouldn't speak even to your wife, altar besicha, is referring to the following. A husband should not come home and be overly graphic about what happened to him during the day of this one insulted him and this one called him this name and this one he got in a fight with or whatever. That is not a positive thing to unload all of your chores during the day on your wife. Why not? For a few reasons. One is that women usually champion their husband's honor more than their husband's. In other words, if the husband got into a fight with somebody at work, somebody called him an idiot or whatever, so he deals with these people on a daily basis, and by the next day, he'll forget about it. But his wife never forgets. And she will fan the fuel of machlokes, and she doesn't come in contact with these people on a regular basis. All she heard is that this guy called my husband an idiot. So she's going to blow it out of proportion, and that's not a positive thing. It's just going to lead to machlokes. Or the other possibility. Every day her husband comes home and says, this guy called me an idiot today. The next day, this guy called me an idiot. You know, after a while, the wife's going to say, you know what, he's probably an idiot because everybody's calling him an idiot. So it's not to the husband's best interest to let his wife know all the things, all the bizyonos he gets, because eventually she's going to start to believe it. So for either reason, right, it's a good idea that certain things, even though husband and wife should be very open with each other, you don't have to unload your, and it works the other way also. Right, all the narishkeit, and this applies most certainly to children. Parents should not get involved in their children's fights, especially when they're little children. I remember I had a balabos somewhere, I'm not even going to mention where, that used to get involved with his children's. He was constantly fighting their battles. First, it wasn't good for the kid. Gave the guy a tremendously bad name in the community. Nobody wanted to let their children play with this guy's children because everything became a big deal. Children fight, they forget about it in 10 minutes. But adults make a big deal out of it, they don't forget about it, it becomes serious, and it's the most terrible thing that can be. So the best thing is let children fight, let husbands fight, and stay out of it. And that way there's much more shalom in the world. Okay, so that's that. Next thing it says. Another thing that it says, Altar Basichem Ha'isha, and this needs explanation. The Mishnah says that you should keep your house open and take care of the poor and let them feel like they're members of your household. Don't speak too much to your wife about how much money to spend on the poor people and what the budget should be, because the Gemara says, "Eine ha'isha tzora im ha'orchi." A woman is stingy when it comes to guests. Hold on before you attack me. Hold on. I knew I was entering the lion's den. I wouldn't have said it if I didn't have an explanation. Stupid, I'm not, but I wouldn't have mentioned this if I didn't have something to. And where do we learn this from? Sarah Imenu. No, you're familiar with Rashi. Avram comes into the kitchen, he has his guests, and he tells Sarah to make bread, cake, right? And Mahari Kemach Solis. Now, Kemach is the not such good flour, and Solis is the good flour. So Avram says, or maybe it's the opposite. Remember, one of them said Kemach, and the other one said, no, Solis. Right? No, use the better grade. And Sarah Imenu was wanted to use a lesser grade. So we learn from here that Isha Eineha Tzoros Im Ha'orchid. Women are stingy when it comes to guests. Now, on the surface, that seems to be not true. Because if anything, women are much more generous when it comes to guests than men are. Okay? However, the truth is not like that, and for the following reason. A woman is very, very protective of her family. Her family comes first, before herself, before anyone else. It's a motherly instinct that a woman has, and a wife instinct to defend her family from in any way. And if she feels that she is endangering her family even in a little way, right, that is something that her instincts lead her to right away be protective. A man loves his family and loves his wife and loves his children, but he doesn't have that motherly instinct. Therefore, whenever there is a feeling that if I give to the guests, I'm giving it at the expense of my family and children, then a woman is stingy with guests. Because the guests are secondary, my family comes first. A husband give away everything. His children, his family. No, that's what's called the guests come first. Because a man likes to impress people on the outside. And therefore, he's willing to do everything for the guests, even if it means that his children and his wife will suffer. Right? Men are like that. Not me, of course, but other people are like that. They're more concerned about what people see on the outside. Men can be very, very fine, bali chesed, with everybody except their own family. And that's a mitzvah. It's not all men like that, but there are definitely a lot of men like that. Women are the opposite. They'll do anything for their family, and if they feel that doing for other people is at the expense of their family, they won't do for other people. They'll choose their family over other people. And therefore, that's what it says. A woman is stingy when it comes to guests, not in a negative way, but when she feels that it is impinging on what her family should get, there she's stingy with guests. So there has to be some kind of balance. So the husband should not talk overly about the budget with the orchim and the aniyim with his wife, because she may consider it impinging on the family. Right? He may want to go overboard, whatever, so there should be some kind of balance, but you shouldn't let your wife decide completely, because she may be stingy at the expense of the guest because she feels that it's impinging on her family. Yes?
Is there such a halacha that if the woman is more generous, and the husband says, ad kan, this is our budget, and that at the door there's a situation where she wants to get more, is she restricted that the husband says...
Under most circumstances, yes. She is. A woman is not allowed to give tzedakah, except a small, average, nominal amount, but something extra without her husband's permission. The reason for that is that basically, halachically, the money of the home belongs to the husband. He is chayiv to give his wife an allowance. He's a chayiv to feed her, support her. She can opt to keep her own money. She can have her own money. In other words, a husband is supposed to feed, support his wife, and she is supposed to give her earnings, if she earns anything, to him. However, the woman has the option to say, don't support me, don't feed me, I will keep my earnings. If she's a nuclear physicist and earns $300,000 a year, and this schlepper earns $5,000 a year, she can say, you know what, keep your $5,000, I'll support myself and I'll keep my own earnings.
But her earnings,
she has that.
Husband.
What? No. In that case, she can keep her earnings 100%. She keeps the $300,000 in a separate bank account. He gets his $5,000 that he earns in a year, feeds himself, and he's not responsible anymore to feed her and to support her, but she can take care of herself. That's her option. She can decide which one she wants.
Okay. Who feeds the children?
Who what?
Who would then feed
the father? Father's responsible to feed his family. Okay. Next.
That's not that everything that a woman acquires after her wedding belongs to her husband.
Yes and no. That's only again, under the circumstance that I said, it doesn't belong to her husband. Under normal circumstances, yeah. But if she opts to keep her earnings and I'll support myself, feed myself, and clothe myself, then she has that option. Yeah.
I'm going to speak for myself, but there are several of us who are either widows or divorcees. We handle our own household. Totally. I have to make decisions.
I'll tell you a secret. There's a lot of women that are married that handle their whole household.
No, really.
Yeah,
and
I understand.
Sometimes you make a good decision, and sometimes you make a bad decision. And it's very, very hard financially to make these decisions right away. But I did receive training from my husband, Oliver Jean Bostwick. How does one run a household? I never read the fine print. It's trial and error.
Yeah, 100%. By men, it's like that, too. I don't think any men ever got any training of how to run a household either, and most of them show for sure that they have no training. It's not a question of men or women. I'll tell you another Gemara. The Gemara says, and this also fits in with Altar Besicha and Ma'isha, the Gemara says, and again, don't jump on me because there's more to what I'm going to say than the first thing.
Listen to
the one. Right, exactly. The Gemara says, whoever follows his wife's advice will end up falling into Gehenna. Now the Gemara asks on that itself and says, is that true? Is that true? When the Chazal said something else that seems to contradict that. What they said is, if your wife is a midget, bend down and listen to every word she has to say in order to follow her advice. You can't selectively like one Chazal over the other. They're both right. They're both true. So the Gemara says, what is the qualification? When, if the person who listens to his wife's advice falls into Gehenna, the Gemara says, kan bimile di alma, kan bimile di shmaya. The simple way of understanding that is, if the question is, what color couch should we put in the living room? Or what color should we paint the wall? That is the woman's domain, right? And follow her advice. If the shayla is mile d'shmaya, heavenly things, like, what hashgacha should we use or whatever, there the man makes the spiritual decisions, the woman makes the more physical, material decisions. However, that can't be, because the Gemara says that when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was offered to be the Nasi, he said, I got to go ask my wife. Now, that was not a physical, material thing. That was a spiritual thing. What was he asking his wife for? Therefore, the answer to that is the following. First of all, it's absurd to think that in a marriage, the husband makes all the decisions when it comes to spiritual things, the wife makes all the decisions when it comes to physical things. Okay? Because a husband has a say also on what color he wants the wall of his house painted, I guess. I mean, to me it doesn't make a difference, but as long as there's a wall there, it doesn't really make a difference to me what color it is or whatever. And I've learned already that my wife asked me, you want this, 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 and whatever I say, it doesn't make a difference. She does what she wants anyway. So what difference does it make what I say? What it means is the following. A person, any two people, any group of people, have to discuss between themselves everything and try to decide between themselves what's the best thing to do. There are certain times, however, when they can't come to a decision. Where one holds very strongly, right, that the wall should be painted yellow, and the other one holds very strongly the wall should be painted black. Now, you can't paint it black and yellow together, and nobody's willing to give in. They both feel this is what's best for the home. Okay? In that situation, the wife wins. Or, even better, you go to a third party and present both sides, somebody who's objective, and see what they have to say. And then both of them can have tainas on the third party, right? And that brings shalom bayis. Same thing goes with spiritual things, right? The best thing is to discuss it and come to a unified conclusion where everybody agrees. If that can't be, then somebody has to make the decision. You can't just leave things up in the air. You have to do something. So there Chazal said, in these areas the man should be the last word and this one the woman. But the last word should normally be what they agree together. That's the ideal. But if that can't be, then somebody has to make a decision. So again, it's sometimes healthier to go to a third party and to ask them objectively, or to get guidance of maybe then each one will want to change their mind a little bit. and compromise a little bit. So that's what I mean. But it's talking not that, so somebody who blindly listens to his wife without even thinking about it in spiritual things, the Gemara says, is going to end up in Gehenna. The best thing is to discuss it, right? Make and come to a happy conclusion. Or if not, then the man's, that's his responsibility in the house. And the woman, and it doesn't necessarily mean mili de alma, mili de shema, it means spiritual things or physical material things. It more means practical things, even spiritual things. But where they're more practical, that's a woman's realm. Where they're more theoretical, the theoretical ideas, ideals, standards, that should be the husband's domain. But a woman is more practical, more lamaisa. Husband's more theoretical. So, and this is not something that's only in Chazal and only in, right, the world recognizes that too. There's a book, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, something like that, right? I never read the book, but I've heard about it.
The title is very good.
Okay. The but it's true.
I think divorce.
Right. The usually, right? Marriage counselors, psychologists are people that are divorced a few times, so they have good experience on how to be a marriage counselor. And most psychologists are completely off their mind, and therefore have a lot of experience dealing with non. Okay. In any case, that's been my experience. I won't tell you what rabbis are, but we'll leave that at that. Okay, in any case, we have finished this Mishnah, and in Yirtzeh Hashem, we will start or continue the next Mishnah, right? Some, we're going to get back into an order here next week. Okay.